All right, y'all, welcome back. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest is the great Gareth Porter, independent historian and journalist. Writes for Interpress Service, that's ipsnews.net. And, of course, we keep it all at original.antiwar.com/Porter. You can also find him at Al Jazeera and other places from time to time. Truth out. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Gareth?
Hi, Scott. I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us today. The piece at antiwar.com today is called, it's up there in the top news headlines, U.S.-Afghan Pact Won't End War or Night Raids. This is the new pact that Barack Obama, they call it a surprise, but they mean he had to sneak into Afghanistan in the middle of the night or else he would have been killed. So he snuck into Afghanistan in the middle of the night and signed this agreement with Hamid Karzai, Afghan president, I guess as they call him anyway. Enduring Strategic Partnership. That sounds great. And it means the war will be over in 2014, just like he promised us back in 2009, right?
Well, of course, he didn't exactly promise that in 2009 or 2010 or 2011 either. But look, basically, Barack Obama has a big problem here. He's in a tight presidential election race, just about to begin. He's got an unpopular war, which in the past has been a, shall we say, a problem for sitting presidents, as we all know. And so that's one side of the problem. On the other side, he has committed himself to this war and committed himself to the interests of the national security state, the Pentagon and the military services primarily, but the CIA as well. And that is to say the CIA's operations wing, which is really the controlling part of that agency. And he's really compromised himself very deeply by his acceptance of their policy advice and his willingness to serve their interests. And so he's constantly, you know, shuffling and trying to find ways to serve both his own political interests in being reelected and and continuing to serve the interests of the national security state. And the way he's done that in this particular set of circumstances, of course, is to not just sign this agreement, but to really build up the notion by assiduously courting the press, or I should say manipulating the press, and, you know, giving a primetime address from Kabul, Afghanistan, on this pact. He's basically presenting this as winding down the war and turning it over to the Afghans. So that's, of course, the
Vietnamization.
Pardon?
Vietnamization, right?
Vietnamization,
that's what Nixon called it.
In this case, of course, it's Afghanization. And indeed, the fascinating thing now is that the memorandum of understanding between the U.S. military and the Afghan Ministry of Defense is actually called the MOU on the Afghanization of what they call special operations. They don't use the term night raid. So, yeah, this is very, very explicitly being followed as a strategy for winning public opinion or perhaps more accurately calming public opinion with regard to the war in Afghanistan. He's
now
not going to persuade people to support the war, and so he's trying to persuade people that, well, we're getting out, don't worry about it.
Right. Now, here's the thing, though. They sort of said from 2004 on in Iraq that this is what they were doing. And I don't know. I'd have to go back, I guess, and I won't. But I'd have to go back and see when it was I finally got it through my thick skull that even though it's taking a long time, this actually is going to work. Because when they mean Iraqization, all they really mean is Badr Brigade and Mahdi Armyization. And once they're done taking Baghdad, they will be the government of Iraq, whether the Sunni Triangle types like it or not. And that, okay, that'll take a while. And it did take a while for that to get completely accomplished. But at least it became an attainable goal of the U.S. military, you know, some point in 2006 or 7 or something.
Something became an attainable goal, but it's not exactly what the Bush administration had in mind. And this is the point at which to recall the fact that what President Bush and his entourage and the neoconservatives had in mind was that they would, in fact, keep, of course, the Shia government in power, but they would push for, you know, sharing of power with the Sunnis and try to calm things down. But more importantly, what they really wanted out of the deal was several tens of thousands of U.S. conventional forces to be remaining in their big bases in Iraq. And that was the controlling purpose of that war. It was to give the United States bases from which to project power in the Middle East. And, of course, that's the precisely what didn't happen, and that represents the fundamental defeat of the Bush administration and the neoconservative strategy. And then to come back to Afghanistan and Obama's situation, first of all, there's no way that he can hope to do what the Bush administration did in fact do, which was to put in power a government representing the Shia majority that had a reasonable shot at maintaining power once the Shias basically defeated the Sunni, basically Al-Qaeda and the Sunni, what was left of the Sunni resistance, and then there was a good deal left of it, in 2006-2007. The problem in Afghanistan is that you don't have any force there that is going to be willing to play ball with the United States at all. The Taliban are going to be remaining the strongest political military force in the country. They're not going to play ball with the United States, and they're going to insist that U.S. troops be completely withdrawn from the country. And so,
in other words, in Iraq, if you were to try to take the metaphor from Afghanistan over to Iraq, in Iraq we were fighting for the Taliban that was going to win all along anyway, and here we're fighting against them.
That's partly true. I mean, in the sense that if you're talking about the Taliban in Iraq, meaning both Sunni and Shia, because I know you referred earlier to the Shia forces who would in fact get into power under the United States, and I think that's correct. But of course, the Sunni resistance never did cash in on the U.S. military's presence. In fact, they were the ones who were the losers in the proposition.
Right.
So, I mean, the Taliban, I would say, represent in this case something of a combination of the two, rather than obviously just the Shia. They do represent something close to a majority, but not quite a majority of the population, in the sense that their natural constituency is the ethnic Pashtun population of Afghanistan. And so it gets a little bit complicated to make that parallel.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, at the time that America invaded in 2001, the people that are the government now were just about licked, right? They were the Northern Alliance, and the Taliban was, you know, they were on defeat's door.
That's right, exactly. The Northern Alliance was not really able to make much of a gain without the intervention directly of the United States. And then, you know, the Taliban regime quickly collapsed because they had not been prepared really for that U.S. onslaught. And they had not prepared really a guerrilla resistance at all. That took them a few years to really make the transition to that.
Well, I'm sorry, this is too big of a question with the music playing, but when we get back, I want to ask you about whether anybody in D.C. really thinks that they're going to win this thing or succeed in building up an army that's going to stay the army of the government that we want in that country for the long term, or if this is all just a Raytheon plot to sell some drones, or what the hell. We'll be right back. Gareth Porter on Anti-War Radio. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Gareth Porter. And interesting conversation. I'm probably not holding up my end of it very well, but it's kind of a interesting sort of conundrum where Nouri al-Maliki, the puppet we put in power in Iraq. In order for him to stay the prime minister of Iraq, all the political pressure was on him that he had to get rid of us, or he was going to be gotten rid of. The case of Afghanistan, Karzai, the president, he needs us. He needs us bad. He can't kick us out. But apparently we can't build him up an army that can even do, I don't know what percentage of the fighting to keep him in power versus the Taliban, which is much more powerful in the country, it seems like.
I think the problem for the United States government, the national security state, and Obama on one hand and Karzai on the other, is that government has absolutely zero legitimacy in the country. I mean, you know, he's a Pashtun who doesn't really have the support of the Northern Alliance types. They still suspect him of being covertly kind of aligned too much with the Taliban. And, of course, the Taliban totally reject him for obvious reasons, that he's basically allowed himself to be used by the United States to hold influence and to use Afghanistan as another jumping off point for the U.S. military in the region. So basically,
and the army they're training up is a giant joke, right? It's a laughing stock of all armies everywhere on the planet.
Well, I think that it's I would say less a laughing stock than it is an army that really doesn't have a very clear cut notion of what it's doing. Basically, you know, what's happened with that army, as I think you know, but very few people in this country know, is that it was supposed to be ethnically balanced so that Pashtuns would represent roughly 40% to 45% of the troops in the ANA, and the non-Pashtun population would represent the rest. That is to say that they would represent 65% of the troops in the ANA. But what's happening, what has been happening since 2007, is that the ANA couldn't do any real recruiting in the Pashtun South, and therefore its sources of Pashtun recruits has dried up, and we don't know exactly what the percentage is, but it's certainly below 25%, continued to go down as each progressive year has gone by. And so now it's really not just an army that's supporting the foreigners, but it's also an army that in the South that represents the non-Pashtun population, or in some cases Pashtuns who come from the North, who aren't really the same as the Pashtuns in the South. So again, there's a layering of illegitimacy here on the part of the army, and I think they really are not very clear on what they're doing, and as you know, the incidents of what they call green on blue killings have not only multiplied, but it's becoming a very, very serious threat to U.S. troops there. That is the killing and wounding by Afghan troops and police of NATO and U.S. Troops in Afghanistan. And that means that they share many of the same sources of dislike and hatred of the foreign presence as the rest of the population.
And now, how many people are there in the Afghan army?
The Afghan army at this point is roughly 100 officially. This is the official count. This doesn't mean that there are really that many troops out there actually in the field. It's about 190-some-thousand troops, 195,000, I believe. That's the official count.
But they have some incredibly high turnover rate, where a lot of guys just go to get some boots and a rifle and then leave again, kind of thing.
It's a very high turnover rate, and that is not contrary to the hopes and dreams of the Obama administration. That problem is not being settled. It's not being solved. In fact, it is a real crisis that is being openly admitted in the most recent Pentagon report on the war in Afghanistan. It's quite interesting that for once they're not trying to hide this. They're admitting that the turnover, the number of troops who just disappeared from the rolls has continued to remain too high. They've not been able to meet their goals to reduce that below the level of, I believe it's 2%, 2% of the total each month, and therefore they're very much afraid that the costs of trying to train the number of new recruits that they have to bring in is going to be so high that the government won't be able to afford it. And that, again, is being openly admitted by the Pentagon. But before I forget it, Scott, I just want to make sure that we cover the point that I should have added to my opening statement, and that is that the mechanism that the Obama administration has used, specifically the U.S. military, has used to basically cover up the fact that this memorandum of understanding between the U.S. military and the Afghan Ministry of Defense to allow night raids to U.S. Special Forces night raids to continue is that they slipped into this agreement a paragraph which defines the scope of the agreement, that defines what are special operations, quote unquote, and defines it as those operations that are basically brought to the attention of this Afghan entity that's going to be making decisions by the United States. In other words, only those raids that we decide to turn over to them are going to be covered by this agreement.
I wonder why they even put that in there at all. Why not just violate the agreement, and who cares? But
well, because, you know, we're a litigious country. We believe that you hire lawyers in order to protect your interests, and that's always what they do. You know, they cover themselves legally. As best they can, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I mean, come on. Hamid Karzai, for years and years, has pretended to be outraged every time, not every time, but many times when civilians are killed. And who knows, maybe he means it a little bit. But he certainly doesn't mean, or else he's really going to join the Taliban now or turn against us. Or
he's certainly not going to join the Taliban. And he knows absolutely that there's nothing he can do about it.
His name is Quisling. What can he do except be a Quisling? He's just,
right. No,
you know,
I mean,
he's not a president of anything.
He's in a situation where he can't really do anything but posture, and I'm sure he's sincerely upset with the United States, but, you know.
All right, but wait a minute. What's the mission, though? If the mission, is the mission build up a government under Karzai that lasts and is stable in a Western nation state there, or what is the mission?
I think it depends on who you talk to. I mean, the military would like to do two things. One, give a good account of themselves. That's 90% of it. And then 10% of it is to actually accomplish, the mission that they set out to accomplish, which is to stabilize the situation in Afghanistan. But if they can't do that, then they'll settle for a result that they can pass off to the American people through the magic of manipulation of the news media and you know the usual methods of manipulation that we are all familiar with by now to convince the American public that we really won, and that if it hadn't been for the news media or President Obama that they would in fact be able to claim a genuine victory over the Taliban. I think that's probably the thinking of the people. From Jack Keane, the guy who gave us Petraeus and who basically was ready to blame the loss of Iraq on Obama, to the current heads of the military services and the commanders in Afghanistan. I think that's what their thinking is. And as for Obama, I think that he just hopes to escape without having this cost him too many votes in the next presidential election, and I think he hopes to do that by emphasizing constantly that we are fighting Al-Qaeda, that we have defeated Al-Qaeda. Don't worry about these Taliban people. We're not even going to talk about them. Just move on. And he's going to withdraw more troops, and he's going to make it sound like that, you know, this is the end of U.S. combat, just like he did in Iraq. He's going to hope that nobody understands that once the deadline for the end of U.S. combat in Iraq passed, which was August 1st, 2010, there were still another 58 U.S. troops who were killed in combat. And so the fighting didn't end. It was simply a lower level of fighting. And we're going to have the same thing in Afghanistan as well, that you may have fewer Americans dying because there are fewer Americans there. On the other hand, the war is not going to end. It's going to continue right through 2014, and he fully expects to have special forces troops remaining in the country, thousands of them. We don't know how many he has in mind, or the military has in mind at this point. Hasn't been decided yet, I'm sure. But they do plan to continue these night raids indefinitely. And don't ask me to explain how the military and Obama and his advisors believe that that somehow can be reconciled with their oath under the Constitution to protect safety of the this country. Because,
come on, none of that ever had anything to do with it.
Well, I agree. I agree. And, I just wonder how they sleep at night. That's all.
Well, you know, more immediately on that question, it seems like this is what conservatives talk about. You know, they like to bring up Lyndon Johnson and talk about, liberal Democratic presidents putting our guys out there in the field but tying one hand behind their back and not letting them do their job. Here they want to pull all the masses of troops out but leave special forces there forever. Well, what happens during the fall of Saigon moment? Other than those guys get blasted, you know? Like, and this is what Reagan did in Beirut, too, right? Put the Marines there and then didn't let them have armed guards at their own damn barracks.
Even apart from the Saigon moment, which, you know, I think is going to happen. I don't think it's going to look like Saigon. It's not going to be, you know, tanks rolling into Kabul. You're not going to have anything that visually resembles that. But there is going to be a moment of truth. But even short of that, even apart from that, I mean, the problem that I'm talking about here, of course, is that what the United States military and the national security state are doing day in and day out is they carry out these raids in people's homes, knocking down people's doors, taking away men in the front of their women and their children, is building up over a period of years, year after year, the enduring hatred of the Afghan people. Certainly the Pashtun people, who are the people who inhabit these regions where it's being carried out, for the United States and, you know, for the NATO allies, for that matter. Some of these people are undoubtedly going to be tempted to join some radical Islamist group that is still following a jihadist course. I have no doubt that there's still going to be people like that. They may, you know, leave Afghanistan to go somewhere else to work against the United States, but, this is the way it works. I mean, this is how the law of karma works in the real world. And this is why I'm saying I don't know how they can sleep at night, because they have to know that they're exposing Americans in the future generations, if you will, of Americans, to the consequences of this enduring hatred that they're provoking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, that's certainly the truth. They've been doing that, playing this same thing, doubling down on blowback ever since September 11th as best they can. But all I was saying about the fall of Saigon moment thing there was, if they're really talking about withdrawing the Army and the Marine Corps and just leaving the Joint Special Operations Command, even a couple of few thousand troops probably isn't enough to keep Kabul from the Taliban, is it?
It's not going to do that by any means. It's not going to be enough. There's no question in my mind about that.
So that's really what I was getting to about the mission, is do they plan on staying to 2024 and fighting forever? If they say special forces, we'll assume that they're going to, you know, that they mean force protection and a giant base for them and everything else, too. But
well, I think it's safe to say, Scott, that nobody in the national security state has any notion of what might happen in 2024 or any outlying year, beyond 2013, 2014. I think that they are completely unable to think in terms of anything that long term, for obvious reasons. I mean, you know, they're worried about whether they're going to get enough money to avoid having to dismantle the national security state as they've known it in the next year or two. I mean, you know, they're facing budgetary Armageddon, as my friend Doug McGregor says. in the military budget. It's very likely that it's going to be cut dramatically. I mean, drastically.
Would Ron Paul win something?
No. I think that this is regardless of who wins. It's regardless of which party is in power. They're not going to be able to continue this.
They got this great bookkeeping trick. They just create debt and then sell it to the Federal Reserve. That buys it with new money.
I don't think even that's going to work anymore. I mean, and I agree. I mean, I admit that I'm relying heavily on my friend Doug McGregor's judgment about this, but he is talking to people in the major defense industry companies, and that is the very strong impression that he gets from the industry. That is, that they believe that this is going to happen. My point is that, I mean, we're talking about a group of decision makers who are, by their very political and bureaucratic nature, tied to very short-term thinking. They're worried about what they're going to be able to scrape up in the next 12 months. They don't have any vision of the future that has any power to govern decisions about Afghanistan. I can guarantee you that.
Yeah, well, you know how the Pentagon is, though. They always, rewrite the language and shorten everything to acronyms. But they also, in this case, 2024 just means, you know, they're stamping their feet and saying, no, we're not going.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, you know, they do have these 10-year projections of various things in the Pentagon, but they're all simply used to achieve a short-term goal, which is to get more of the budget. I mean, that's the fundamental reality.
Yeah. Well, and then, anyway, we can sit here and belabor the point about Afghanistan forever. Let me ask you one more thing real quick before I let you go here, Gareth. And this has come up numerous times, and I know it's besides the point, but people get in arguments and they need footnotes. And you're the walking footnote. So the question is, hypothetically, if Iran were so provoked by Israel and the United States, by, say, you know, a carpet bombing campaign that lasted a few weeks or whatever, that they decided that they would withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty and take their breakout capability and turn it into an actual atom bomb or two, how long would that take? Because, of course, everybody says once your uranium-235 is enriched up to 20% pure, why, at that point, it's all downhill and real easy to get it up to above 90% purity for weapons grade. And so then it's sort of like dot, 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 and fill in the blank yourself. It makes it sound like it's a matter of turning on the light switch or something, and all of a sudden, within, I don't know, a weekend or a few weeks or something, the Iranians could go from what they have now, which is wink, wink, legal, to all of a sudden an atom bomb, breaking out from the NPT.
Yeah, I mean, my answer to that is, of course, I don't know, but that I distrust the methodology that is supposedly used to come to those estimates of whether it's a few weeks, a few months, a year, or whatever. I just don't trust that at all. I don't trust the people that are using it. I don't think that they are motivated by truth. I think they're motivated by the necessity to come up with a line that is useful, to support the policy that the United States and Israel have had. So my answer is that I don't know, and I think it's relatively irrelevant. We don't know, for example, nobody really knows how far along the Iranians are in terms of designing a bomb. I mean, the assumption is that they know how to do it, but nobody really knows. And furthermore, I mean, you know, there's a whole series of steps. They'd have to put a bomb on a missile for it to have any significance to be able to deter anybody. And my conversation with Uzi Rubin, the father of the Israeli anti-missile program, missile defense program, was very revealing in this regard, because he said, look, he happens to think the Iranians probably will get a bomb someday, but the point that he makes to me is that they have a conventional deterrent strategy with their ballistic missile program. They've designed their major ballistic missiles to reach Israel for conventional weapons. And their deterrence strategy is fully based on non-nuclear payloads. So, I mean, that's to me the real point here that needs to be emphasized.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's all very relevant, but I guess I'll see if Doc Prather knows.
All right.
Because, you know, people get bogged down in the minutiae sometimes, and, you know, the more complete an argument, the better, you know? And even the way I put it is, it seems like, you know, Warhawk types like David Albright, if he says it would take at least months and months and months, and, you know, their centrifuges are kind of junky, and their knowledge about how to do all of this right is absolutely necessarily incomplete, and it would take them a while, probably half a year or worse, kind of thing.
Well, look, I mean,
that's meaningful, right?
That's why I say the key judgment that I have is that I don't trust people like David Albright, and for reasons which you know quite well.
Yeah, well, all the things he gets wrong, I understand that.
Yeah, exactly.
Those
so, I mean,
things.
You know, I don't have the technical knowledge myself. I don't
right.
know who does have the technical knowledge and the strict approach to trying to get at the truth that would be necessary to make that judgment. But I think that it needs to be put in a much larger perspective. And
right.
That's what
well, and you know, probably the most important point of all of that is in the hypothetical itself, that they would have to withdraw from the treaty and tell the whole world, oh, yeah, screw you guys, I'm going home and I'm making nuclear bombs. Because
yeah,
there's
course,
no way for them to do it as is, never mind all these additional protocols they say they're about to agree to, et cetera.
Let me just say, Scott, that I think the real headline in the current situation is that the whole Israeli threat to attack Iran is really collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
The notion of existential threat to Israel is no longer credible, that nobody really believes that the Israeli government genuinely believes that is a threat. That most of the people in the national security apparatus of Israel who have any significant authority there have come out and said that they're opposed to this. It looks to me like Netanyahu was bluffing all along, as I've said on your program.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what we've been looking at for the last, 5 months now, since last November, is really a bluff by Netanyahu that the Obama administration decided to make into a way of putting diplomatic pressure on Iran. So you've had a good cop, bad cop routine going on now for the last five to 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's clear that that is not going to work, that the Iranians are not impressed, that they're not going to be influenced by the threat of an attack. That's just simply, it's a non-starter. It's not a significant factor.
Yeah, you know what? There's been a few trial balloons like that where, oh, you know, the Iranians, they're starting to feel the pressure. They're going to bend to it. That is clearly not how this is going to work, if it's going to work at all. It's going to be that
yeah.
the Americans are finally honest for a change and cut the Iranians a break and simply say, look, accept the additional protocol with a few bells and whistles and we'll lift some sanctions and stop threatening to kill you. That's the deal.
Big,
it's as obvious as can be.
That's the big question. Will they agree to lift sanctions? I think that's, at this moment, the thing that is the deal breaker. The biggest potential deal breaker is the refusal of the United States to go along with significant lifting of sanctions from Iran. I mean, that's the dangerous point in this situation.
Yeah. Well, you know, if only there was a faction in domestic American politics that cared about this.
That would help a lot, yes. If we had any political force of a magnitude that could make a difference, yes.
Yeah, well, we got the Paulians.
We do. We do.
Anyway, for what it's worth. All right, well, thanks very much, Gareth. I've already kept you way over time. I appreciate your time, as always.
Thanks for having me on the show again, Scott.
All right, talk to you soon. The great Gareth Porter, everybody, ipsnews.net and original.antiwar.com/Porter.